listening to The Martial Brain, the podcast that explores the intersection between the martial arts, science, critical thinking, skepticism, and that wacky organ that floats inside our skulls in a pool of cerebral spinal fluid, making life unpredictably inspiring, infuriating, and sometimes just batshit crazy. I'm Jeff Westfall for The Martial Brain. An American Muay Thai Tale, Part 2. The Student, Early Days. Last time I told you about my amazing Muay Thai teacher, Surachai Sirisut. Today I want to describe for you my path to Muay Thai. When Ajarn Chai moved to the U.S. in 1968, I was 10 or 11 years old, and probably in mourning over the fact that the TV series The Green Hornet, with Bruce Lee as Kato, had just been canceled after a single season the year before. By 3 years later, I had moved on and begun my own training in the martial arts, beginning in the art of Kyokushin Karate. I added training in Tai Lung Kung Fu in the mid-70s, and boxing in the late 70s. Through my early years in the martial arts, I had heard of Muay Thai, just as I had heard of dozens of other exotic martial arts, mostly through my reading. But in Evansville, Indiana, in the 70s and early 80s, I was no more likely to experience what Thai boxing was really like than I was to taste Ethiopian food or to hear Tuvan throat singing. I do remember, though, in the mid-70s once, when I was eating at a restaurant that featured as part of the ambiance black-and-white movies projected on a screen on the wall with no sound. The content varied from an old melodrama to a travelogue to sports. One of the sports offerings featured two men in a ring wearing nothing but shorts and boxing gloves, punching, kicking, and kneeing each other. It was Thai kickboxing. I immediately forgot my meal and intently watched the sadly short depiction before it switched to an old silent slapstick comedy. The little bit that I had seen didn't impress me, though. You see, this was the stage of my martial arts journey where I was doing all my sparring with less than heavy contact, as was typical of the Asian striking arts as taught and practiced in the U.S. at that time. I had probably, at this point, already competed in the form of tournament karate called point fighting at the black belt level. Without engaging too much in tooting my own horn, I won more often than I lost. So I had developed a bit of the typical arrogant confidence of a successful young athlete. In a few years from this point, I was to meet and begin training with boxers, each of whom would quickly give me reality checks by punching me in the face. But these reality checks were still in my future, so at this point I was still quite full of myself and of my opinions about anything martial. "Look," I said to whatever poor sap was sitting with me, "they're standing squared up to each other. Muay Thai can't work for self-defense. Their groins are wide open." What I didn't understand was that, if anything, Thai boxers have excellent technology for defending the groin. While groin attacks are illegal in Muay Thai, it's perfectly legal to kick to the inner thigh, which you may have noticed is in the same anatomical neighborhood as your groin. As a matter of fact, groin kicks and inner leg kicks look so similar coming at you that it's hard to tell them apart with perfect accuracy. But as it turns out, that's not really a problem. As you would imagine, skilled Thai boxers are very good at defending against kicks to the inner thigh, and virtually every defense that is effective is equally effective against a groin kick. What this means is that groin kicks are almost a non-issue for Thai boxers, and that the early version of me watching the silent film was an idiot. Another detail I noticed when watching the film was that it appeared to me that the striking techniques of the fighters were less than effective. This impression was, of course, another example of my youthful ignorance, combined with the indoctrination from Kyokushin Karate. The fighters depicted in the film were hitting each other frequently, but not knocking each other down or out. One principle that was strongly emphasized in many styles of karate is called Ikken Hisatsu. This translates into English as to destroy with one strike. The idea is to develop your striking technique to such a level that you can consistently render your opponents dead, unconscious, or incapacitated with a single blow. Believe it or not, this really was a thing in the culture of the martial arts as they were practiced in America in those days. Not only was it a thing, it was a central principle in many, quote, hard styles, unquote, of karate. It affected the way that the rules for sparring and competition were developed. It affected the way you were taught to think about what one of your strikes would do to your opponent if you really landed it. Mention of the doctrine of one strike, one kill made black belts nod knowingly to one another and to respectfully intone, "Us." Now, assuming that this is actually a realistic goal and not an unattainable platonic ideal, you can see how useful this ability would be. Successfully fighting multiple opponents suddenly seems not only possible, but plausible. Of course, over time, and through bitter experience, I was to learn that Ikken Hisatsu was a less than realistic paradigm when it comes to fighting in the real world. While it is true that a single blow can knock out, incapacitate, or even kill an opponent, each of these outcomes is statistically highly unlikely for any single strike you might throw. To base an entire major martial arts principle on such an improbable feat doesn't make sense to me, at least not now. But at the point on the timeline of my martial arts career when I was watching the grainy black-and-white film of two Thai boxers, I had yet to experience my bitter experience with real contact fighting. That was to come when I began training with boxers. I'll never forget one of my first sparring matches with my good friend Kevin Young, who taught me most of what I know about boxing, when I punched him hard in the face with my deadly right hand. I was not yet used to sparring with hard contact, and I hit him much harder than I had intended. Now, I had been so indoctrinated by my karate training to carefully control my striking that I was afraid I had badly hurt Kevin, and I immediately made this noise. Kevin, only superficially affected by my punch, upon hearing me make this manly sound, dropped his hands and asked me with grave concern, "Are you all right?" This experience was part of the beginning of my education in the fact that some opponents are much harder to hurt than others, despite how deadly you think your striking skills to be. Yet to enjoy the benefit of this education, and while watching the film at the restaurant, I saw the combatants trading blows without apparent effect on each other, and I thought, Muay Thai strikes must not be as powerful as karate strikes. Yep. That's what I thought. Remember that young and foolish thing? Yep, here it was again. In addition, I had yet to develop the critical thinking skills that I would develop decades later. Specifically, when it comes to evaluating data based on sample size. I was acting as judge, jury, and executioner of an entire martial arts style based on less than a minute of viewing of only two representatives of the art. I had no way of knowing whether they were good, bad, or mediocre examples. Now please don't misunderstand part of my point here. I don't want to hate on hard styles of karate in general, and on Kyokushin in particular. I benefited hugely from my time training in Kyokushin. Its emphasis on rugged toughness and intensity did a lot to help my nerdy young self man up just a bit. But I do believe that the heavy reliance on the doctrine of one strike, one kill, combined with my later experience with boxing, went a long way towards driving me out of this art. My next peripheral experience with Muay Thai was with a sparring partner who was not a practitioner of Muay Thai, but who had trained with some gentlemen in Louisiana who claimed to practice Thai boxing. I've actually discussed this guy before on the podcast in episode 125 entitled Believing is Seeing, Part 4. I mentioned then that of all the people I've ever sparred with, he had by far the most explosiveness and the most imperceptible initial move. His game did not look like that of a Thai boxer, but he did throw what we called in those days the roundhouse kick, or at least one variation of it, very differently than did any other karate or kung fu practitioner I had ever met. When using this particular version, he barely snapped from the knee at all, which was standard form for a roundhouse kick in karate or taekwondo or kung fu, and he completely committed his hip when he threw it. He claimed to have learned this variation of the roundhouse kick at the gym in Louisiana where he had briefly trained. When he kicked the heavy bag with this particular kick, he nearly always bent it in half. It was a vastly more powerful kick than any roundhouse I had ever seen. He sometimes remarked that he liked it, but that it was difficult to use in point sparring because of the hip commitment, which made it tricky to use in any but a full contact sport. But at this point, I was already well into the process of de-emphasizing point sparring and was researching techniques that could hit really hard. So my sparring partner's kicking method fit right in, and I worked hard to emulate it. Then in 1984, I attended my first training camp with Dan Inosanto. I didn't go there seeking knowledge of Muay Thai. Rather, I was on the hunt for training in Bruce Lee's techniques and concepts, and also in the Filipino martial arts. I noticed, though, during the week of training with Mr. Inosanto that he frequently mentioned Thai boxing and the benefits he was gaining from training in it. I went back to St. Louis the next week to take another week-long seminar, this time with Bill Superfoot Wallace. That was an amazing seminar, too, and I learned a great deal. I plan on discussing it in a future podcast. During this particular week, there were two other seminars going on at the same time as the Bill Wallace one, and one of them was a repeat of the Dan Inosanto seminar. One afternoon, the administrators of the seminars gathered the attendants of all three together in a gymnasium, where Mr. Inosanto made a presentation about Muay Thai and its benefits. As part of this, he brought out two pairs of the training devices called Thai pads. Thai pads are worn on the forearms, along with stout handles at the end for your hands to grip. They are much more thickly padded than focus mitts and are vastly better engineered to take the ridiculous power of Muay Thai kicks and knees. Mr. Inosanto asked for two volunteers to come out and kick the pads. The challenge consisted of executing powerful rear leg round kicks on the Thai pads for 3 minutes without stopping. The point being to demonstrate just how cardiovascularly demanding this is, and thus how difficult it would be to finish. The other attendees of the Bill Wallace seminar began shoving me out to the front, where I grudgingly accepted and volunteered to take part. The other volunteer was Dwight Woods, who now runs a martial arts school very similar to mine in Miami, Florida, and who recently interviewed me on his Facebook series, Jeet Kune Do Dialogues. For each of us, this was our very first time ever kicking Thai pads. Legendary instructors Larry Hartzell and Cass Magda held the pads, with Mr. Magda holding for me. Mr. Inosanto got out a stopwatch and shouted, "Begin!" My time spent adopting my training partner's version of the roundhouse kick really paid off big this day. While, as I was to learn later, it wasn't a perfect representation of the Muay Thai style of kick, it was close enough that it served me well here. I lit into the pads with gusto, my adrenaline dumping a bit because of the presence of so many of my colleagues. I remember thinking, this is going to make me really tired, really fast. Just before, Mr. Inosanto shouted, 38 seconds have elapsed. I was in pretty good shape, though, and somehow kept going to the end. But when I was finished, I was indeed exhausted. Dwight made it very nearly to the end, but wasn't quite able to finish. Mr. Inosanto came over and put his arm around my shoulder before pulling me off to the side, where he said very nice things to me about how I had just done. He then said, "I strongly recommend that you seek out my Muay Thai teacher, Ajarn Chai, and train with him." It would be a couple of years before I was able to save the money and find the opportunity to do just that. But that, dear listener, will have to wait for the next episode. Anyway, that's what I think. But I could be wrong. Let me know what you think, and check out old episodes of the Martial Brain podcast at my website, rpmartialarts.com. I'm Jeff Westfall for the Martial Brain. The Martial Brain is produced by Raging Squirrel Productions in association with the Rising Phoenix Martial Arts Academy. If you like the podcast and would like to help it grow, go to iTunes or Stitcher and give it an honest rating and review. Contact me with questions about the Martial Brain or about the Rising Phoenix Academy at my website, rpmartialarts.com.